I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Bacchus in repose, he delights in fragrant liquid detente. No moderation dwells within his downpipe, his cornucopia is boundless, his buds tasteful, his gullet ever unquenched. He is Ollie Smith.
Ollie Smith, the wine expert, the greatest palate in
Christendom.
greatest palate in Christendom.
Everything to excess, apparently. Yeah. That's great.
That's you, yeah.
Fantastic.
The living Bacchus.
I love that idea. Yeah, just riding around in a chariot being fed booze, causing a rumpus.
Isn't that what you do?
Pretty much. Yes, Jim.
And are you like, when he says like Bacchus, do you have fountains with wine coming out of them, great gullies leading to sort of stone baths that you sort of bathe in?
I want that. Mm. I really want that. I want my house to be a shrine to pleasure.
And
so
you've got boiling hot tea water and another one that supplies whatever wine you want from your cellar.
Oh, that would be great. And you could blend them as you go. You could blend your bespoke wine into your glass depending on your mood. I love this idea. We could call it the wine hose.
Well, the wine hose.
Very good.
There is a place in, I think it might be Bruges, I think it is, where the idea is you can pay a local brewery to get pipes direct from the brewery to your house to feed you your favourite beer, and I think you subscribe for life. This may just be a dream I've had now that I'm saying it out loud.
No, I think you're right, yeah. I was travelling through a wine region, which I can't remember which was, but it was a shed, a garage, if you like, with great big vats of fine, like Chablis.
Oh, I like this.
And there was old women with buckets filling up the buckets from the huge, a very fine wine, just for daily use.
I think there's something in this. The idea of serving wine, you know, that's amazing. Just really informally. Like, I love being on holiday. Wine in a beaker, any type of wine, always makes me feel like I'm having a great time.
Yes.
And I think when you do have, like, really amazing wine, it's almost an excuse to have something really filthy alongside it. So fizz with chips, or really amazing red wine with just thinking. That's the sort of combination
I like. Somebody said to me, a friend of mine who's a great, sort of huge sort of wine man, he said, oh, what you want? He said, with the grandest wines, you want the simplest of foods.
Yes.
So you'd often find him having a bit of cheese on toast there with the sort of 61 Latour or something.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I like the idea of, what are you having with this wine?
Some thoughts.
Nice, I like that.
Yeah, some thought. I actually was on a cruise ship last week and I met a guy who was 101 years of age. And I said to him, listen, I can't let this opportunity go by. You're in my wine bar. Here I am, sharing a glass with you. I've got to ask, what is the one piece of vital information you would pass on to me in my middle years? And he looked me up and down and he said, have you got a record player? I said, yes, I have. He said, Frank Sinatra, Count Basie, Live at the Sands, with a glass of red wine. It cannot be beat. The pinnacle of human achievement. And I hadn't really heard the record in ages. So on the way home, I was listening to it, got myself a glass of red. And I thought, you know what? I love the idea that what he was expressing was just go out and enjoy the moment, the live moment, the real moment, with a glass of whatever you fancy. And
yes,
I thought, what a legend.
What a great thing to do, yeah. And that is a great record.
It's amazing. But isn't it great that you're of that age, right? And he's still travelling. He's on a cruise ship having the time of his life.
Yeah.
He's attributing his longevity to a passion for live music and a glass of red wine. And he's full of the joys. I thought, wow.
Yes, I think that's right. Enjoy yourself and things are better, you know.
Totally.
That's right,
every time.
So you go on cruise ships a lot.
Yeah, I do. I've got wine bars on P&O cruises. So I do, I was just on the Maiden for Iona going up to Scotland. And it's a beautiful ship. I mean, she's got sort of three or four decks of glass around the atrium. So it's kind of like bringing the outside in. You've got these incredible widescreen views, in this case of the Scottish Islands. Dolphins were frolicking around. I mean, it was so idyllic. You know, and there's me swanning around with my wine hose, gushing all over everyone.
So, with the, but how big was the hose? What sort of opening on the nozzle? If you want the nozzle,
well, I think we should have like a spray to reach the widest number of people as we can.
Let the wine breathe as well.
Exactly, Jules.
I go for Saga, and it's so lovely, so relaxing. In fact, I think we should get Jim on there. I think they'd love you.
Well, I could go on with you, Ollie, and you could just give me the wine, and you could see the effect.
Do you know what?
Because I literally wind me up, and I will go.
Yeah.
But do you think that would be quite interesting? See the effects. In other words, like, you know, if you look into the window of a big department store and they'd have a living room set up there. So you'd have a sort of a living room set up with you in it and just being given wine, and people would just observe you and how you behaved.
Yeah.
I think that would be quite nice. I'd watch that.
Can you operate a piano after, let's say, 2 bottles of wine?
No. I wouldn't operate heavy machinery, a motor vehicle or a musical instrument after too much.
It's an interesting thing, though, because the drinking song and the drink that goes with various types of music. I remember being in Nashville and being amazed at the kind of, you know, the bourbon and the story of lost love and that kind of reflective moment. There are sort of combinations that seem to find each other in music and booze. But I think Jules is right. I think surely too much of it and you're just shambling around like Oliver Reed at a barnyard disco.
Yes, I think in the actual, when it comes to the physical playing of it, you want to have a pretty clear head, I think. But once you're listening to it, that's a different thing altogether. So I would, for instance, especially what you've said earlier, I really like this, what you're going to pair your wines with.
Yeah.
I did actually the other evening. I had some Italian, some Tignello, very delicious Italian wine.
Lovely.
So and also because I knew that night we were having some spaghetti.
Yes.
So I put on a little bit of 1930s Italian opera music.
Oh, gorgeous.
To make the whole thing. Yeah. And I even found a little red and white checkered tablecloth on top of the card table there.
Yeah.
That's right. And so I like to get, you know, it's nice to put all the things together.
I think it totally
is. And each thing then tasted and sounded better.
It's proper time travel, liquid time travel. You're travelling with your ears. You're connecting more deeply with the artist in the moment. It's truly extraordinary. And wine does this as well. It is literally a portal to another place and time in liquid form. It was so made somewhere else.
Let's say it's 1975.
Yes.
You've got Wings.
Oh, my goodness.
Band on the Run, maybe, something
like
that.
Oh, I see.
You've got some pineapple rings, cubes of cheese and ham. What do you drink?
I would try and find a hobbyist British vineyard to pair with that from 75, because fizz keeps really well, and it would be intriguing to taste something from that era that was probably not made that professionally, but that probably has incredible character, loads of personality, and was as daring and as unexpected maybe as Bannon.
And was there anything around then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the real Renaissance happened in the 50s in Hampshire. But before then, you know, we were growing grapes in this country right back to Roman times. They kicked it off. But it was lost and found. Monasteries kind of did it a bit. But it was really since the 50s when it started again, and now, since the 90s, we're seeing the most extraordinary Renaissance, the most wonderful time of innovation, of skill. And I just always reflect on this. I think, look, if you gave me 20 quid and said, here's some squishy juice in a pint glass, can you give it back to me in 5 years and make it taste nice? I don't know what I'd do. I'd lose my mind immediately.
So what you're saying is actually the way you're describing it is that these English winemakers are turning lead into gold almost.
They are. They really are. We're in a marginal climate, which has its benefit if you want to make edgy, characterful wines. But it's really tricky. So places that have done this successfully in the past would be, you know, New Zealand, you know, Marlborough, and in the south in Otago, and now they've got the name for themselves, and I think we're going to do the same.
Now, the last time I saw you, Ollie, you were at my house.
Yes.
We opened a very nice old bottle. It was
1982,
and I thought it was going to be rank, and it did turn out to be rank, but the first moments we opened it, it was really nice, and there was probably one glass out of it that was worthwhile, and it went off. I didn't know wine did that. It went off in about 15 minutes.
That's it. I remember when you were going to open it very kindly, a Chablis, and I said, look, we're going to have to work fast, because this stuff literally, it's so frail and fragile. It's like us when we're kind of 101. If you tumble us into a wine glass, we're going to be a bit brittle. So as soon as you've poured it, older wines, they do tend to vanish quite quickly. So you've got to, make heavy work.
I mean, the best wines have a longer life, don't they?
They do. And if you have a really amazing year, like there's, you know, the legendary moments like 1945, I think, is one of them. And even further back, then they are reputed to live really well. 1953 Margaux is another example that everybody kind of goes for. But I kind of think almost, yes, those are sort of grail wines and they're interesting and they're fascinating. But if you really want to taste old wine, the stuff to go for is fortified wine like Madeira, because it's all already oxidized. It's bulletproof, and it can live. It can outlive us. It can live forever. I've had that stuff from the 1800s, and even like brandies and stuff like that. I remember being given a little sample by a bloke called David Baker, who's a real kind of senior citizen in the world of very, very fiery booze. He gave me an 1805 little tipple of a cognac.
Oh.
And I remember thinking, hang on a sec, this is Trafalgar. This is actually Trafalgar juice. This is like, when they were doing that, the sun was hitting these grapes when they were living just north of that battle. This is extraordinary. And the amazing thing about it was it didn't taste old or saggy or musty. It was vibrant. It was like someone had put 50 volts through a pineapple. I loved it. And I think those wines that can live, whether they're fortified or distilled, as they get more scarce, they vanish. And you need to know someone like David, who's very kind and occasionally opens a little tiny capsule amount of it, just tips it into a thimble, and you think, oh my God, I'm drinking Napoleon.
Well, that's all you want just for that moment, isn't it?
That's all you need. It's incredible.
Are you a keen transport person? Do you like travelling around?
I love travelling more than anything. I love the people you meet, the vistas going past. And actually, Jules, inadvertently, you were responsible for me buying my first classic car, which you don't know. But my head wine host in one of my wine bars, once upon a time ago, said to me, you should drive a Rover P5B coupe, you know, like Jules Holland's got. And I said, I don't know the car. I don't know what it is. And I believe the story goes that you did have one. And I kind of got interested in them. I kind of drove a couple, thought they looked amazing with the Buick engines, fantastic. And in the end, I did track one down. And I got it from a wonderful guy in Wales. And I'll never forget the transaction. It was after a gig I'd done in Manchester, middle of the night, driven the car around. And I said, yeah, I really want to buy the car. And he said, well, I've had a lot of interest from people in Germany, from people in America. But I remember that evening very clearly. He looked me in the eye and he said, I'd like to buy the car. And he said, well, I don't know if I want to sell it to you yet because I don't know if I like you. And I thought, that's a really intriguing thing to say to someone. I was like, okay, cool. What do you want me to do? And he said, well, let's go for a drive. Let's find out how much I like you and if I like you.
Oh, this sounds a bit saucy.
Well, it could be, Jim. Unfortunately, my luck in that regard was out that night. But he did eventually. We sat at his kitchen table and he looked at me and he said, well, I've decided that I do like you and I will sell you the car. So I transferred the cash into his account. I'll never forget. He was at his computer and he said, Margaret, we're rich. We're going to have a Chinese. And it was just an epic moment of transaction. And I've stayed in touch with him. And I love that car. I call it he called her Daisy because her number plate's D-U-K. But I call it the Duke. And I roll around in it. And I always listen to Jimmy Cliff. It's a hard roll.
What, are you still going now?
Oh, yeah. One
is
CD.
Is it in zircon blue?
It's not zircon. Okay. I love the zircon. It's in silver birch and then the grey, the lovely. It's got the dark roof and then the kind of the crease, beautiful. And then black and the headrests in the back.
Oh, lovely.
Full tool kit.
And is it... Yeah. Oh, so lovely. She runs well?
Sweetly. She does, Jim.
Because
really
it is
does.
Luxury, isn't it? It's a luxury car.
You know, I get the picnic tables down, I pick people up from the station, couple of glasses of fizz. You're right, Jim, it's luxury.
I mean, that's the thing that you don't get in a modern vehicle, which is really useful, is a picnic table.
Too right. Mine came with a big history file, which I pore over. And I love, like, reading about where it went, you know, how it was serviced, what the other owners did to it. And I kind of, you know, it's a dream, really. You're layered in, like, the strata of other people's lives. It's bonded into the fabric of the car. And it's that, again, on a human level, just families and stories coinciding. It's a wonderful thing to share momentarily in the history of the Wagon.
What was the first vehicle, do you remember?
Yes. Let's be clear. We don't start with the Rover P5 as something that we work up to.
No.
Where did you start?
So the first car that I properly fell in love with and that I actually owned was a Volkswagen Golf GLS Silver with kind of blue fabric interior. And I loved it. It was probably an early 80s, late 70s maybe model, Mark 1. And I remember it distinctly because my dad gave it to my brother and my brother sold it to me for 500 quid.
I
remember thinking, and at the time, my brother and I were living in a little place in a kind of shared house in Middleton Square in Islington. And having an interesting time in a house full of, you know, great characters all going off and doing interesting things at the beginning of their lives. I remember driving off from there 500 quid light off to my life in Scotland for a while. But I had the most wonderful feeling of freedom, and that car gave me, you know, the cassette deck, listening to things, you know, of the time, like Dire Straits Brothers in Arms and Now 2 and all of that stuff that was just floating in the ether. I just, yeah, that was a car that I really regret selling, actually. And I remember having to sell it to live, really, when I was at uni.
You didn't sell it back to your brother?
No, but I wish I had. Mm. I sold it for 250 quid. I remember thinking, oh, it does pain me that, because that's one of the cars that got away. But the first car I really coveted that was on my kind of wall as a kid was a 308, a Ferrari 308 in navy metallic, dark navy metallic. Oh. Yeah, and I just loved the look of it. And, you know, it was the time when the kind of in the Bond films, Roger Moore was driving Lotus Esprit Turbos, so they kind of figured in there as well.
So you had a poster of a car on your bedroom wall?
I did, yeah. And, I had cars. What else do I have on my bedroom wall? Oh, it depends which age range.
Roger Moore.
Well, yeah, I probably had Roger on there. And, yes, in fact, I almost certainly did. And then getting to know him in later life.
Did you?
Yeah. I did so he nearly died, very sadly, of a heart complication on stage. And my friend Dan was an animator. And he was really concerned that Roger Moore was going to die before I'd had the chance to meet him. Because, he's a great kind of hero of mine. So he wrote this little animation called Roger Moore's Requiem, which I think you can still find online, to Verdi's Requiem. And it basically showed what would happen to Sir Roger Moore's soul if he died without first meeting me. And let me tell you, it was a terrifying image. But Rog saw it from his hospital bed and was tickled pink. So he got in touch and reached out to Dan. And I mean, I've never jumped on a friend harder than that, riding Dan's lapels, breathing so hard into his face as I said, "We have to meet Roger Moore." And so we got in touch and we said, "Look, why don't we do an animation for UNICEF? You know, you obviously work very hard for the charity." And he said, "Well, I'm recovering, you know, feel free to pop over to Monte Carlo. It sounds great, lads." Well, we were on the next plane. And seconds into meeting him, he'd been my hero for being Bond and the Saint and all the rest of it. But he was just such a down-to-earth, lovely man. And he talked immediately about, you know, the work he did for UNICEF, wanting to help people with goiter, who suffered from AIDS, who, you know, education for girls. All of the stuff that came out of his mouth made me think, you totally are my hero, but for all the right reasons and for none of the former kind of, you know, stuff, the persuaders and all. I love all that still, but just the man, what a beautiful soul he was. And I did get to know him, loved a glass of Sancerre. He always used to tell me about this legendary trip he did with Michael Caine and Leslie Bricusse on holiday, driving through the Loire Valley, basically having a really wonderful time drinking lashings of wine. Oh, I'd love to have been just trapped in the boot for that one. That would have been epic.
How lovely.
Yeah.
What a lovely idea. What a lovely idea.
Roger, he was wonderful.
What did you have on your bed? Do you have any cars on your bedroom wall?
Well, they say you are who you've got on your bedroom wall, don't they? I had a picture of Arthur Lowe.
Well, I applaud that.
I did have pictures of cars, actually. And I had a diorama.
Ooh. Yeah.
Thank you. So I think I had a garage with various vehicles laid out.
Yeah.
In what would be...
positions.
Their positions once I had my diorama.
Mine was full of model Airfix aeroplanes everywhere, all over the place, which was horrific for my mother who had to dust them. But I had a poster of Jim Clark.
Oh, nice.
And Apollo 11.
Oh, yes.
Before it got then started getting overtaken with Roxy Music and various things and stuff like that. Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, I did also, I think it must have been about 1972, you could bring up, there was a General Motors dealer called, I think they were called Lendrum and Hartnum, something like that, in Berkeley Square or something like that. And I put a put on was, "Hello, I'm interested in buying a new Buick or Cadillac. Could you send me the brochure, please?" And they say, "Yes, certainly, little, certainly, Sonny. Where should we send it to?" And they sent me, I think they realised I was just a lad who was interested, and they sent me the 1972 brochures for the sort of Cadillac Eldorado and the boat-tail Buick. And those cars at that time, I mean, vast, gas-guzzling sort of monsters they were, photographed with people leading very glamorous brochure lifestyles, much more glamorous. I mean, with the Humber and the Rover, you might have a man with a slight wisp of grey hair showing his senior management credentials and maybe a slightly younger wife, and they're just coming out of a thing with a dinner jacket, you know, they're just saying. The American ones, they were so glamorous, the people, and the width of their lapels was greater than anybody had ever seen. It made the Sweeney look like sort of pygmy lapels, and their ties, and they were people like Macmillan and wife, or whoever the people on the TV at the time were, but shot in such a way that was so glamorous. It was a lifestyle that you couldn't believe. So I lived in those brochures for a while, imagining that if I had one of those cars, I would be living that life. And I had some American cars, but they were all much older than that.
Mm.
Rather nice, big sort of
Studebakers and all that, you know. I was driving along Route 66 filming a beer show a long time ago, and I remember the It was a sad story, actually. It was the owner of the car, his wife wasn't very well, and he was trying to sell the car to fund treatment for his wife. I remember we'd rented the car to shoot this piece. And my favourite memory of the whole thing was just seeing his face driving along Route 66. As I had to kind of hide in the back for a drone shot, I think, and I was covered in a picnic towel. And if you look really carefully in it, you can just see me wriggling around and, you know, God knows what I'm doing under there. But I remember his face just absolutely lighting up like he was 8 years old playing with a dinky toy in the back garden, which is what I kind of, you know, remember that my first moments with cars, dreaming of the stunts and the tricks they could do. And yeah, for a moment, you know, together, he was free of his troubles and embracing that huge wide sky above his car. It was epic.
I'd like to do that. I really would. You know, I've never done it.
We never quite know what's going to happen on the road in the States. I remember one of the strangest moments. I was driving late filming. We were driving into Nashville and I remember getting closer and closer to the kind of strip where all the bars are, and the neon was just bleeding into my gaze, and I was just completely overwhelmed. It was like somebody just melted a billion lurid lollipops from 1981 all at the same time into the sky. And I was trying to make sense of all of that, all of the kind of soundscape that was pouring out of the bars, the general hubbub of people all around. And then to crown it all, there was this bloke dressed as a full cowboy riding his horse at me in the street. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is Nashville. This is amazing. And I spent the most beautiful few days there, rolling in and out of bars, learning about just how extraordinary life can be. I love the States. I just think the...
And what were you travelling around in then?
I think for that, I was riding a bus. I think I'd borrowed a bus off a mate in Portland, like an enormous GMC bus, I think, with an awning on the side that we used for kind of picnic shots. So it was like an enormous great thing thinking back. So yeah, it's a very hazy memory, but I have very joyful memories of all the different corners of the States and arriving in different ways. And it's unique, you know, what you're driving and where you're driving into. It sticks with you.
But
totally.
It is nice to do that thing, you know, like you are riding in something that's iconic.
Yeah.
That you've seen in a film. I remember the first time I went to New York, I thought, I am in a movie.
Yeah, movie cars are a whole other thing as well. Last year, I drove the Aston Martin DB5. You know, they did that replica, the Goldfinger replica, with all of the guns, the smoke, the bulletproof shield. I think it's cost like £3 million, and there's one you can buy to go on the road. The rest of them, I think, they just sell them to put in people's piano bars. I don't know. I don't know what the extremely wealthy would do with it. But I remember driving it along and thinking, this is so extraordinary, because it is... Everything in it is as in the movie, and it's meticulous, and to actually engineer that on one car is incredible. But it was a very modern handling on the vehicle, so rather than driving around in a great big sort of floaty boat of a car, it was far more defined. And I just felt this in a way it was a shame that I was just driving to Milton Keynes, because where I should have been driving to was, of course, over, was it the Gotthard Pass, I think, in Goldfinger or something like that, some epic alpine backdrop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but yeah, I was just off to Milton Keynes.
But that's so often the way of it, isn't it?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Have you ever been on any very dangerous roads?
Oh, I've had danger, Jim. I've had serious danger. Can I go off the road for a dangerous tale?
Yeah.
Can I go boating? Because there was a very dangerous moment when I was... I was out off the coast of South Australia in the Great Southern, and we were filming this thing about great white sharks, because it was my big terror in life was great white sharks.
So hang on, why did you go near them?
Because
then?
They
get
paid,
over it.
They paid me. I was, you know, it was ITV, and I thought, yeah. And there was actually seriously a bit of me that thought I really should try and confront it, because I hadn't swum out of my depth as an adult really my whole life. And they put the shark cage in. No great white sharks came all day. The weather was getting up. You know, I hadn't even got in the cage, and the camera crew said, the director said, right, let's just get in, we'll film something underwater, we've just got to get something, come on, Ollie. And so I do my piece to camera, and I'm like, well, here I am, you know, about to go in the cage, I've been marinating myself in wine for 40 odd years, so if these great big sharks don't fancy that, well, I don't know what they will. And off I get into the cage, and literally as I get in, a great white shark the size of a 73 bus just cruises so close to the cage, and you can still see it. It was so frightening, and yet the fear dissolved relatively quickly into a serenity. And I admired just how tranquil that beast was, just moving along. I didn't see it as a monster. I just saw it as something that it was such a privilege and joy to see so close in the wild. And then I hopped out, and they said, the sea's getting up, we've got to get back to port. And these two captains I was with, they were really cool, collected young Aussies. You know, Aussies very rarely show any kind of fear at all. And as we went back, I remember we were with another boat, the sea really got high. I remember we were quite close to the other boat, and the waves were so big that we couldn't see it when we were pitching up and down. So everybody on my boat was getting really ill. I thought, okay, I'm going to deploy my fail-safe seasickness cure, which is to listen to the Beatles at high volume. It's 100% successful.
Great tip.
If you ever need to know, and the happier the song, the better. Love Me Do, you know, that all the early stuff, it will cure you. So I was the only person on the ship who didn't puke. And as we're going along, there was one massive wave that totaled us, and the two captains stopped talking and went ashen white, and then began again. And when we hit shore, I said, just out of interest, lads, when that wave hit and you stopped talking, was that just you concentrating? And they said, no, we thought the ship might go down. And it was the closest I've ever been to
going
knowing
down that, in shark-infested in waters.
Jules Holland, that's exactly the point.
Which is your greatest fear.
And I'm the only one not covered in sick. So I'm the only delicious person left.
I was in Chester. This is not as exciting, but it's similar. I was in Chester doing a film, and I don't know what it was for, but I was in a huge tank. It was the biggest one in Europe, apparently, and it had a giant bull shark in it, and I had an aqualung on, and I was holding on to the side, and the fella said, whatever you do, don't make any movements or it will go for you. and as it came past, I was clinging onto the side to these rocks, and I could feel the grip starting to loose, and I started clambering back onto the rocks on the wall of this tank. And just as the bull shark was coming around, I just started flapping around, waving my arms, like almost right in front of its face, saying, why don't you just come and eat me? And my arms were flailing around everywhere, but it just cruised straight by.
Nice. And did the annoying man say, I told you not to move about?
Oh, yeah.
They always do that.
Interesting, it did, the shark thing, it did cure my fear of sharks in the water, though. I do now swim.
Well, we've got one in a tank next door here.
You haven't got a shark in the tank. You want me to do it now? Is that what this show's
always saying, when this show's over, we just want to test to see if you're happy to go into the shark with four bull sharks that haven't been fed for a week.
Okay.
And you go in there, and we want you to listen to dance to Beatles music in the tank with them and see how it goes.
Marvellous. I'm in. I'm 100% in.
Just going back to the travel of wine, some people say, well, like, for instance, Guinness, it is true, tastes delicious in Dublin, but doesn't always travel. Like, you get it elsewhere. French wine, delicious in France, but, you know, by the time you've got it to California, might not be so good. Does wine travel, do you think?
It can do. They're getting better at preserving it at the right temperatures, and they're getting better also at keeping it out of direct sunlight and keeping it in an order that it would reach you in perfect nick. But I do think there's something to the idea of enjoying certain flavours where you are. So, you know, I love going to Greece, and I love Greek wine as it goes. You know, they've got a lot of boutique producers, small scale, really delicious grapes that maybe we don't know that well. But it's my kind of pet hobby is Greek wine. I absolutely love it. But I've reached beyond the wine there now, and I'm quite happy when I'm there to dive into a little puddle of ouzo, and I'm even going to squeeze myself into a barrel of Retsina.
I was in Greece the other week. Retsina, how can you drink it? But if I'm there and it's freezing cold,
yes,
and I'm sitting in a little Greek island,
bit of squid,
then I want it.
There is one that I think the Wine Society bring in that's less resonated and a bit fresher. So Jim, if you imagine it's less earwax and more lemon basil.
Mm. I think I can convert Chateau earwax.
If you'll have me back on the show, I'll bring you. I'll bring a bottle
of Retsina,
of good Retsina, and we can put it to the test.
Well,
I've got another question, another wine question, which somebody said some of the great French, famous French wines, some of grand ones as well, were actually Irish. And I said, really? He said, yes, because in the Napoleonic Wars, Irish mercenaries was go and fight or whatever, and then after the wars, they were presented as sort of gifts from the state as big vineyards. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, I mean, Talbot, Chateau Talbot. I said, yeah. He said, well, that's an Irish name, isn't it? Is it? He said, Chateau Meini. I said, no. He said, and then he said, O'Brien. I said, O'Brien? He said, yes, it's O'Brien.
Is it O'Brien? Is that true? There is truth to it, absolutely. And not just in France. You know, if you think of the port industry, a lot of it is still owned and run by a lot of Brits, you know, because we had a really close relationship with Portugal. I forget which monarch it was that married Catherine of Braganza, but that formed this great historic alliance. And whenever we were out fighting the French, we'd always kind of nick round the back and stop buying French wine and buy it from Portugal. So there's a lot of English people out there making port, you know, there's, you know, I mean, there's all around the world. It strikes me that wine is this extraordinary, I mean, it's going to sound ridiculous, it's this fluid way of us connecting with each other, not just through the liquid but through the business side of it as well. And you know, whenever I'm in places like Australia, I remember I was floating over the Yarra Valley in a hot air balloon, and I was expecting it to be really windy up there, but of course, because you're traveling at the same speed of the wind, it's entirely still. And I was peering down over all these vineyards, and I was thinking of all the people who'd come from all over the world, lots of Brits who'd come under, you know, difficult circumstances, who'd made a life for themselves, eking out corners. And it's really beautifully hilly, and you can really see how all the aspects, all the facing hills, have an impact on the flavours. So if you're facing north in the southern hemisphere, it's going to be warmer than it is on the southern slope. And so if you've got grapes growing on the southern slope, they're going to be sharper, they're going to be more precise, more defined. Northern slopes are going to be richer. And I was looking down and just thinking of all of this kind of history, this geology, this geography, this commerce, this farming, these lives over the years that just build, knit and forge these links in the land. And it always fills me with just the greatest thrill, really. And I'm a very small cog in a very large world of booze. I just absolutely love what it is.
So if you're giving a lecture,
yes,
and you're tasting wine, how long before you have to give the lecture up?
Oh, you mean before it has to lie down?
Basically, how much can you drink?
How much can I drink? Well, you know, because I've been round your house having a few. I can go okay. You know, I would say as the years have gone on, you know, a few glasses I'm still able to hold court. Obviously, if I'm doing a tasting, I'm going to be spitting, so I wouldn't be, you know, enjoying it. But if, you know, if we're out for a few, I mean, I'll stand by you, Jim.
You'll go the length.
I'll go. Yes,
the gauntlet's been tossed down.
It has now. So is this next door with the sharks? There's going to be loads
exactly,
of shots.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take you into our cellars see how long you can both last for.
I guess it's something that, you know, in the booze trade, people don't talk about that much. But the obvious effect of having a few glasses is that you become merry, you become more relaxed, more convivial. There's conversation, etc. And I see it as a positive aspect of it. Within the confines of moderation, and obviously alcohol addiction is a terrible thing, but I don't see the booze as the devil that a lot of people are painting it as in the days we currently live in.
I mean, some people it has a very bad effect.
Of course, they shouldn't drink.
But on the other side of that, I have been in situations. I was having dinner with some people, I think maybe about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have that much in common. And they brought out this incredibly grand wine.
Yeah.
As we slowly consumed it, each of us became more eloquent and amusing. Yeah. I certainly did.
Yeah.
And each of us were more agreeable.
Yeah.
And each of us became more sort of humane in our thoughts to one another and the world beyond. And it was interesting how the good quality booze had this effect of lighting us all up and improving us. And I mean, by the end of it, I was absolutely brilliant.
You were hilarious. I'd like to comment on your shirt, which is a kind of checkered pattern with a sort of futurist cubist picture of London with the London Eye, St Paul's and that. Now, I think I've seen that on a current tube train.
I think you could be right. I think this is travel wear of the highest order. This is from Gresham Blake in Brighton, who I love his designs and shirts, and I think you're bang on. I think this is indeed something we've all sat on.
The patterns that you get on...
Yeah.
on tube trains, which you can actually get by now as furniture.
Can you get the kind of textiles? Can you get
you can get the vintage textiles, can't you?
Yeah.
Which from the London Transport Museum, the material that they would have on buses and trains from the 50s through to the 70s, you can buy all that and have it on your sofa.
I think you can go further back. I think you can get it from the 30s as well, because one of my favourite ones is when the trains started to go out into the suburbs, when the newly created suburbs. There's a pattern which is a beautiful sort of futurist design with green leaves on it.
Oh, how lovely.
It leaves the capital.
Taking you to the old sort of Metroland dream of Tudor-Beethan England.
I love that, because there are so many memories. Like in the 70s, I remember my granny in Bournemouth taking me and my brother on the top deck of the yellow double-decker buses. You know, I remember the feel of the kind of the seats, and I think I could pick out the fabric if you flashed it in front of me. But I just remember such happy days, you know, sandwiches on the beach, big thermos of tea that tasted like TCP because she cleaned it out with TCP. But just those, that it would bring back so much.
Well, in those days, it would have been the orange, black and yellow stripes.
I think it was.
Yeah. And that's a great pattern. That's one of my favourites.
Ooh.
The patterns on those buses and tubes and trains are quite fantastic.
Yeah, and they're texturally pretty kind of
bold. Or if you're wearing shorts.
Oh, yes, that itch on the back
of
the
just knickers.
Yes.
Well, yes.
And I mean, particularly if you've got those sort of... and you could then draw... I have tattooed on your legs the maps of the London Underground or something like that.
Imagine those girls in the 60s in the miniskirts going to Hammersmith Palais and then getting off the bus. And they would have like those like red seat marks on the back of the legs.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'd like to leave this with... thank you. I'd like to leave you with this thought. In fact, it's a tip. If you're, and I won't reveal who this person was, but somebody of great note came to my house, and it was about sort of 12:30, 1 o'clock, lunchtime sort of thing.
No,
about
12:30.
Exactly. It was a perfectly reasonable time. And they were sitting there chatting a perfectly reasonable way, and they reached into their pocket, and they pulled out a small tissue and opened it up, and in that tissue there were some crumbs of rather mouldy cheese. And they said, well, I bought this cheese. Should we have some wine with it? So I then had to go and get a bottle of wine. But I thought it was a very good way.
It's the best prompt.
Yes, exactly. It's so that's my tip prompt of how to get...
You were going to say they opened a pair of knickers with some cheese in it, which
had been on the London Underground.
Put these on and we'll have some wine. Well, I think we've probably exercised our manners well enough now, haven't we?
I think we've learned a great deal, and we've had a lovely tasting, and our palates are fully sort of mobilised, and we've learned a great deal and had a lovely time, haven't we?
Well, a marvellous, marvellous picnic. Thank you very much. Ollie Smith.
Thank you, Ollie Smith, for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there goes Ollie onto his cruise ship, clutching desperately onto a bottle of Paddy McGinty's Gold.
Yes, the O'Brien wine, which I'm so pleased he confirmed that. I've been wondering about that for years.
I'm glad we cleared that up.
Yeah.
This podcast was produced and edited by Molly Stewart.
Sound engineers were James Stewart and George Latham. By the way, the purse, I didn't want to reveal anything, but the person who came around with that, it was my dad.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.